amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. I've got Steve D with me this week. No sign of Paul this time. It's October 28th, and it's been a busy week in the stock market. We've had earnings from most, not quite all, but most of the biggest US tech companies in, and we'll largely be talking about those. There's been some other really interesting earnings along the way too, but we don't have time for any of them. Too much other stuff to be talking about. Important things like, Steve, how has your week been?
Not bad, Steve. Very, very slow day, slow week at work, and continuingly slow week at work. We've been learning how to make origami ninja stars and then throwing them at the gong. We have a gong in the office, so if you get a big order, you get to go and ring the gong. But there's no orders going through because there's no quotes. So we've made origami ninja stars, and you have to try and hit the gong from the other end of the office. So that's what we've done this week. In terms of stock market, I think it was, I don't know, to be honest, because I deleted all my Google Finance data out thinking it would still show me the week's performance, and then remembered that it's obviously not going to do that because I've not got any weightings in on any of the stocks. So I've had to go through on Friday and put all of those back in, which shows me that I basically got 0.7% green on Friday, which I think is quite different to a lot of other people. And the S&P itself was down 0.48, so quite a good Friday. That was driven by Deckers up about 19%, and Amazon was, it was about 7%. I think it closed just under that. But the rest of the portfolio didn't seem to fare quite as well. But had some really good referrals on Webull as well, Steve, as I've been taunting you with all week. I think I've had another four people sign up, but Webull have just started chucking random $100 share amounts of Amazon at me now. I've got $200 worth of Amazon given to me, and about $160 of Apple on top of the 360 quids worth of Apple they'd already given me in this latest round of referrals. So, Steve, I think I'm going to single-handedly bankrupt Webull at the moment because I don't have much intention of leaving it in there, to be honest. How about you, Steve? How's your week been?
Well, good to know that people have been buying and then dumping shares in big tech companies across the board here. You say taunting me with these things. It's kind of hard to do that, really. I mean, it's maybe an annoying feature of our show. Maybe we should be a bit less like this, I think. But both of us tend to be kind of pleased when the other one does well. So I'm genuinely quite happy, to be honest. I have no stake in Webull. Although I have a free something or other that I put into Realty Income, which is sat in there. So I suppose I don't want the platform to go bust because that'd be a nuisance if I had to try and recover two shares of Realty Income from them or the cash equivalent. My Friday ought to have gone fairly well, I think. I mean, I've got Amazon. Amazon did pretty well. The stock went up. In general, it was a down day for me and a down week as well. So not so strong on the stock market side. We'll get into the reasons why, I guess, in a little bit when we talk about some big techie things. Also, I don't own Deckers, but it was nice to see Deckers doing well. That came up on our 212 notifications. Another company I think you're single-handedly trying to take ownership of. But or at least, I guess you'd call it a soft power, grab the amount you post in their forum. Gradually, they will make you, I imagine you're kind of planning some sort of coup where people vote you in as trading 212 chief, and then you get a t-shirt with a bigger trading 212 on it. Otherwise, the week's been all right. A bit of illness earlier in the week, which made life heavy, and it made things get busy towards the end of the week, which is, I suppose it's nice to be busy. I'd rather not have the illness bit early on, but that happens. It was half term, so we've been dealing with the challenge of having the little one around all the time, which is probably also something to do with the illness bit. Overall, not too bad. Looking forward to getting him back into nursery and getting back down to stuff. It's an interesting week coming up for me for reasons that I will come back to. But maybe we should talk about stuff that we've consumed, because that's where my stuff fits in here. What have you been consuming this week, Steve?
So I've been consuming something completely new to me. So I've seen a few little clips come up on TikTok before today of a show called The Rest is Politics. And not being massively interested in politics myself, I've never really checked it out. Plus that it's got Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart as the two heads of it. So ex-Tory politician Rory Stewart, I think he moved to some kind of centrist party and then has left it altogether. And Alistair Campbell, obviously known as Blair's spin doctor, I guess, is probably what he's most famous for. Neither of those people particularly interest me. But yeah, on the search of something to consume for this show, I thought I would give it a go. And I am really, really enjoying this podcast. I don't know if it's two negatives make a positive or whether I actually appreciate these two more outside of the political landscape or not. But yeah, they're two quite thoughtful, smart individuals, well-connected individuals who know an awful lot about the world. And when they're not towing the party line and just saying whatever the illustrious leader tells them they need to say, are quite, listenable people. So I'm going to recommend episode 185, which starts off with global perceptions of Israel and Gaza. But I would, encourage you to get through that bit. And there's a Labour and Lib Dem bad blood section, and then a whole section on China teetering on the brink of economic chaos. And it's a really thoughtful discussion between the two of them, quite well sourced and has lots of interesting stats, such as Rory Stewart just blurting out in the middle of it that 80% of the world's sex toys are made in China. That's the kind of level we're talking about in there. So really interesting. I'll put a link in the description. I actually highly recommend it. I've been going through the back catalogue. There's 185 to get through, Steve, so I'm probably not going to do it. But there's a lot of really interesting topics in there. A lot of interesting guests. I spotted that the fella who, what's the guy called? Reid Hoffman, sorry, has been on there and talking about friendship, and he left quite an impression on Alistair Campbell, which is unusual because he's not the sort of person that you would normally like talking to, a tech billionaire. So really interesting. Highly recommend it, and see how you get on with it. How about you, Steve? What have you been listening to?
Interesting move away from our kind of usual stock picking stuff, I guess, or maybe macroeconomic stuff as well. I'm not sort of hugely surprised. I think I agree with you. It's a kind of weird product here in that it might be quite a good podcast and a good listen and so on. And I'm not surprised to learn that Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart tend to be quite thoughtful guys. It's natural to, including in their cases, Rory Stewart stood for leader of the Conservative Party as well. And as you know, Alistair Campbell is fairly heavily entrenched in a kind of New Labour thing, and they spend a lot of their time kind of pushing outwards against everything else in politics. It's very natural to lump all kind of politicians in as party hats, basically, and think that's all they think, and all they do is mindlessly shove the party line forwards. I think I'm probably not terribly surprised to learn that the number of people who get into politics to do that probably rounds to zero, and that's more kind of what happens when they get in there. I think nearly everybody in politics gets in there with good intentions to make the world a better place, to make the country a better place. They have different ideas about how they might do that. They may even have different ideas about what a better place means or looks like. But the idea that they are capable, left to their own devices and free of the kind of shackles of having to cooperate with people in order to get things done and horse trade and bargain and that sort of thing, I'm not surprised that they are quite thoughtful here. They're, as you say, very well connected, so they're pretty well informed as well. And the idea that they have the capacity to process their information pretty well isn't really news to me. I agree with you that it kind of is quite potentially a decent product there, or a good podcast with a fairly horrible bit of packaging on it. Because if you have a good product, why would you stick it in a box that says Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart talk about stuff? It's like the opposite of branding and marketing and stuff, right? It's the idea of these things is to kind of pull you in and go, oh, I wonder what that's about. And like, oh God, I'm not watching that. When actually it's really quite good. I'm not sure quite how I think they would have done it. They needed a catchier name, I think. The Rest of Politics is pretty good, but maybe hide the fact that it's them a bit further back would be my thought on that. But no, I'm not surprised that it's a good show, a good thoughtful show with people who are well informed and capable of of processing their information in a sort of fairly intelligent and reasonable way. Whether you agree with either of them is up to anybody else, but you can have sensible people who disagree with you. I've been looking at slightly more traditional fare for us this week. I've been listening to Business Breakdowns, which is a podcast that we've definitely talked about on here before. I'm not sure we've talked about it in the consumption segment specifically, but I've been listening to the episode of Business Breakdowns on Rolex, which is slightly unusual in that normally when I see the latest episodes of Business Breakdowns come out, I have one of my reactions come on a scale. Down the one end, there's, oh, great, this is a stock that I own and I really love to know more about this. To slightly further along, there's, this is a stock that I'm really interested in buying or could be interested in buying and would like to know a lot more about this. To down the other end of, this is a company that means nothing to me and I have no interest in this at all. Maybe I'll get to listening to it because there are general lessons that you can take from specific businesses that don't apply elsewhere. I haven't got much time to be sifting through things looking for how to apply things elsewhere. And Rolex very much goes into that end category. It goes into the category, I have no interest in buying this, mostly because you can't, because it isn't publicly traded. So this is not going to be something I end up buying shares in, or at least not expecting to. So why the interest? Well, they were advertising on a different show that they've decided to label their Rolex episode as timeless. Because they think it's one of their very best ones that will age well and has important insights and lessons and so on that will persist going forward. So I thought, okay, let's give it a run. The episode is terrific. It tells you all kinds of interesting things about Rolex, about business. But I'm planning on using it in a slightly different way. So aside from teaching philosophy to a bunch of people who are studying for degrees, I also teach philosophy to a bunch of people who are not studying for degrees, but they're on leadership programs. And their leadership program has kind of two halves. It has a sort of business half and a sort of morals half. And people have said for a while it'd be nice if we can join these up to think about business ethics, basically, is the obvious way to do this. Business ethics means, in the current context, it usually means something like ESG, which we all agree is garbage, but is roughly a synonym for ethical investing or ethical something or other. So I've been trying to put together a seminar which goes roughly like, well, how would we think about businesses ethically if it wasn't through this rubbish ESG framework? What are the different ways that businesses can do good in the world or make the world a better place? So, for example, Pfizer makes the world a better place because they produce a COVID vaccine. No one else produces a COVID vaccine. Is the world a better place for having a COVID vaccine? Yes. Does that make Pfizer a good company? Well, you go discuss. But there's a claim there that the world is a better place because Pfizer is in it. Rolex is really interesting because they give away nearly all of their money. They're privately owned and they donate large sums of the stuff they make to local Swiss charities or local Genevan charities more specifically, which is sort of fascinating because it's tempting to think Rolex caters to the very high end, the very fanciest. They're very selective about who they sell to. None of that's a big surprise. It is a big surprise that they then go and pour nearly all of that money elsewhere into causes that are ostensibly good causes. And this stuff checks out, by the way, if you go and have a look. This isn't just lies and stuff they tell you to try and push their image forward. So I'm planning on using it for that as an interesting kind of counterpoint in that seminar and thinking, what's good about this? What's bad about this? Does doing good morally automatically come at the expense of doing well as a business? So I've been listening to Business Breakdowns for that reason, not as an investor necessarily, but as someone interested in this particular business and the way it sets itself up with a view to how ESG might look if it were run by some people who actually know something about ethics, basically, or are capable of thinking about ethics other than, oh, I must find a number to attach to this thing. Let's look at their carbon emissions and put a number on them somehow. That's my contribution here.
That's interesting. I had no idea about that. You would just assume, just by naturally thinking, that well, Rolex, they're obviously going to be hoarding the other people's hoarding money, and some soul at the end of it is getting incredibly rich off the back of it. But no, that is really interesting. I had no idea. So Business Breakdowns on Rolex, that's going on my list of things to watch in between The Rest Is Politics.
Yeah, really good episode, actually. The guy on it's very, very good. I've forgotten his name. He runs Hodinkee, which is effectively a luxury goods kind of newsletter, kind of marketplace, kind of bunch of stuff. But he really brings some energy to that podcast, too, which is which is exciting to see. So that's what we've been consuming this week. None of it probably tells you about which stocks you ought to buy. We don't really tell you about which stocks you ought to buy. That would be advice. But none of it is about stuff that we're interested in buying in the near future. Let's get on to some stuff that is about stuff we may be interested in buying in the near future, shall we, Steve? Or at least stuff that we own.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's kick off then with some big tech earnings. Let's start with Alphabet, because the week did. They came first in the list of big tech stuff that we had reporting. This was around Tuesday night going into Wednesday, UK time, that they reported things. Their revenue growth is up 11%, taking them to 76.7 billion in the quarter, which is pretty impressive. Their margins also widened. So one of the things you'll hear from us quite a bit, I suspect, on this episode is that these big tech companies have been in cost-cutting mode. They've been in efficiency mode. They've been in widening margins mode. And what happens when you widen margins and you boost revenues at the same time? It's a pretty clever trick. I won't compare them to anybody else who is doing the opposite of that at the moment. But your earnings per share go up. In general, unless you print loads of them, which they haven't. So earnings per share were up to $1.55, which was a 46% boost over this time a year ago. Under the breakdown, though, stock went down as a result of this, and it's a little hard to see why at first. The kind of only real obvious point of weakness in this was, it sounds strange to call this a point of weakness, but I guess let's put it this way. Their cloud revenue from Google Cloud, one of their kind of emerging projects here, and a promising looking emerging project, was 22% higher, which is quite a lot, to be honest. I'd take growing most things at 22%, but that was lower than Wall Street was expecting. It also swung to profit as well, instead of being a loss-making thing, which was equally handy. It was lower than Wall Street were expecting. Ruth Porat on the call said this was largely due to customers pulling back in spending, but they reported the same day as Microsoft, who said that their kind of cloud revenue was up 29%. So the market wasn't really having it in this case from Google. And the stock got lower, fell by about 5%, I think, at first. So that's kind of the overview. There's some questions about what we should make of this. Should investors be so worried about Google's cloud? The ad market stuff was very strong. There was growth in their ad sales and services and so on. But Steve, what did you make of this as a report?
I think the market was right to be somewhat concerned about it, because growing at 22% versus Microsoft's 29 was Azure's growth, was it, Steve? Give me a nod.
Yes.
Obviously, Azure is growing from a higher base as well, which is you know, which kind of says that Alphabet's excuse probably isn't as strong as they maybe thought going into the call. Don't book it on the same day as Microsoft is what I would say, is if you want to use that excuse. And for investors, it's really important because it just diversifies Google away from that sort of ad-focused business. So we really want to see cloud and Google Play to that degree to come along a lot more, just to diversify that revenue stream a little bit, so we're not permanently worried that the regulator is going to come in and stick some big boot on advertising and upset that for us. But this is what we said, Steve. A couple of quarters ago, we were saying we wouldn't be surprised if we saw Google returning to double-digit growth, and that's exactly what we've seen here. So they're back now at 11% growth on their revenue, 9% on ads, and then there's 21% on Google Play, 22% on Google Cloud, and then there are other bets brought in a little bit. That's things like Waymo and Verily and things like that. Interesting to see YouTube back growing again, Steve. That's now that was up 12% year on year. That's now 8 billion. I was looking at the revenue run rates for YouTube just versus Netflix, which is when we were looking at the Piper Sandler survey last week. They were the two that were getting compared. And it's been a constant battle between the two to see who manages to get the most revenue in the quarter. Google surpassed it in Q4 2021 quite considerably, but then has since fallen back, beat it again in Q3 2022. And now we're just sort of getting back to the point where Google is hunting it back down, ready to overtake Netflix again. But an interesting little battle between the two. And if you're watching at home, I'll try and remember to put the graph up so you can see the battle between them. But this is a fine report, Steve. There's nothing wrong with this report. It's gone down 5 or 6% on the day because it's up a lot this year, and it was up a lot running into these earnings. It's an impressive business. I have no plans on selling any of the stock I hold in this business. I probably wouldn't be on the hunt to buy any more at the moment either. but I don't think I'm a million miles away from buying, Steve. I just think there's better bargains out there. How about you?
Roughly the same conclusion you had. We don't usually confer notes too closely on this, although I suppose my thoughts on this are in the public domain since I did write about this during the week and it's been published since then. Alphabet's up 38% year-to-date, even after its pullback on the last thing. The S&P is up around between 7 and 8 on the start of the year. So keeping these things in context a little bit, it's fair to say investors are feeling optimistic about Alphabet and its capacity for growth from somewhere in both the near future and, I suspect, the more distant future too. It does rely heavily on its kind of ad market stuff. I saw Librarian Capital, who, by the way, I rate very, very highly on Twitter. I don't tend to talk about people on this show that I don't rate highly, because as far as I can see on this, there's rarely much fun in on this kind of platform anyway, sinking the boot into people who are just clearly talking rubbish, because why? You know, people say obviously silly things. They don't need me to tell them they're talking, that what they say is silly. Librarian Capital are a sensible bunch. They thought the drop here was entirely unjustified. And they thought the drop here was entirely unjustified because cloud is such a vanishingly small part of Google's business at the moment. It is dominated by that search, that ad revenue, and so on and so forth. It's 78% of their revenue and kind of almost perversely, it's over 100% of their operating income. The reason being they lose money elsewhere. So their operating income is actually lower than Google's services total. I think Librarian Capital are wrong about this. I think they're a sensible bunch, good, thoughtful bunch of people. I think being concerned about Google's cloud stuff, yes, it is only a smallish part of their revenue, but I think you should keep a close eye on that because it is supposed to be, as you pointed out, diversifying things away from just relying on ad revenues. You put it in terms of a regulator. I think other people are putting it in terms of ChatGPT and Bing and so on. There doesn't seem to be a massive amount of evidence so far that Google's losing any kind of market share on the search side. And actually, the business there is performing quite well. But it does look... if you were worried about an undiversified business in some way or another, you should probably get back to thinking slightly more about that sort of thing. So if the idea was that cloud was going to take over and become a meaningful part of stuff, you'd be looking for faster and better growth than this. And I think you'd probably be justifiably looking for, as you say, Microsoft coming off a higher base, you'd be hoping for Google Cloud to be keeping pace with Azure in terms of growth, because that base is an awful lot higher. So I thought the drop was also justifiable, and I felt the same way as you. Spoiler alert, with this and Meta and Amazon, I eventually concluded that I have hold ratings on all three of these. When I say that, I mean genuine hold. I've seen YouTube videos from people who I won't name because I think this is silly, who say, yeah, I have a hold rating on this thing, so I sold it. And I sort of think, well, do you know what hold means? If you think, I was like, oh, I can't have this as a hold, so I sold all my stake and bought something else instead. Like, okay, I think that presumably means you think it's a sell because you went and sold the thing, or your stated and revealed preferences are not quite lining up here very well. I think this is a hold. If I had it, I wouldn't sell it. If I didn't have it, I wouldn't buy it right now. I think looking at a dip on that is very much staring at the fine details on a much, much larger chart here. Big tech in general has done well this year. I think because investors, and I don't think this is crazy, by the way, see it as a fairly defensive place to go hang out. Big market position, very hard to disrupt. Strong balance sheets pretty much across the board. It's not the worst place to go hiding out in a recession one way or another. The trouble with hiding out in there is that they come at quite high prices at the moment. So if you're looking for somewhere to hide, you'd better be a bit wary of multiple contraction. Google and so on are, well, Google and Meta are in the 30s or close to 30 at the moment, PE-wise. That's, with interest rates at 5 or whatever percent, that's actually fairly high. It's a lot higher than it was when they were at zero in the COVID stuff. So those are roughly my thoughts on Alphabet here. I think I'm probably in holding mode.
The time to buy all these was about October last year when everything was, they were all under 90 and Meta had almost completely crashed. And if you would have held them through to today, you would have done really handsomely out of it. I mean, I was buying like a maniac back then in Alphabet and Amazon. I think I tripled my stake in Amazon. So I've got over 10 grand of my own money before growth in Amazon, so that kind of shows you how aggressively I was buying. It's by far my biggest position. I think it's 13 or 14% of my portfolio, but in the same vein as you, I'm not in a massive rush to buy anymore. I probably won't buy anymore for a few years. I need to really level out my portfolio a little bit, and I plan on doing that by buying and not by selling.
It's fascinating, isn't it? A couple of quick things before we move on. You can make these points, actually. I've got them written generally up the side of my notes here, but you can make them about any of the next three or in the context of any of the next three. I agree with you that the time for buying them was a while ago. I mean, of course they do. The prices were lower. That's not an insight. I think they'll come again. I think there will be a time to buy these things again. Some antitrust thing will show up somewhere. People will worry about things. Someone will see a small dip in user numbers somewhere, which will be a temporary headwind. And then there'll be another kind of, I call it meta-like reaction. It happened to be meta before, where users went backwards and the bottom fell out of the stock. That will happen again, and there'll be times to buy it again. I don't think that time is right now, when everyone's feeling largely pretty good about these things. Okay, a bit of a wobble on cloud stuff, and I think there's justifiably gives investors pause here. The only other thought on my mind at the moment, just in the context of all three of these, is it's not so very long ago, to my mind, that people were touting equal weight S&P things, because they were saying, look, you are so heavily exposed to big tech if you just buy the S&P at the moment. The S&P is not, it sort of is and isn't a diversified index, right? It's got stuff from loads of different sectors and stuff from different market caps, but it is all America, basically. And it's quite heavily weighted into big tech at the top end, because... Okay, I think Google strictly gets classified as communications, but whatever, it's basically tech over there. So people were saying, you should like buy the equal weight version. That would be much better as a thing. If you bought the equal weight thing a year ago, you would have missed loads and loads and loads in terms of gains from the S&P 500 this year, because it really has been pulled along by that top end again, like it was in the sort of early COVID stage. So I'm just slightly conscious that this is perhaps a bit of a short-term loss in terms of not a win for people who were advertising for an equal weight S&P as a thing to buy. Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
Cool. Well, that's pretty much it for Google, I think. Amazon reported on Thursday night going into Friday, Steve, and we both own this stock. So what happened there?
Quite an interesting report from Amazon, Steve. Again, we were another company that we were saying, don't worry about today. This again is not finished growing. There's still plenty left in Amazon, and that one really did start to show through in this report. So I've got the numbers for you, Steve. I'll just quickly flick through them. They're very impressive, and I'm gonna just give a shout out to Vision Capital for putting them together in such a very easy to understand way. And quite concise. So revenue was 143.1 billion. That's plus 13% year on year. Net income came in at 9.9 billion. That's plus 244%. Margin came in at 7%. That was up 464 basis points, because you know I love to switch between the two, Steve, for you. Operating cash flow was 21.2 billion. That was up 86% year on year. Margin 15%, up 586 basis points. Free cash flow came in at 9.9 billion. Margin of 7%. That was up 979 basis points. And then just to top it off, trailing 12 month operating cash flow was 71.7 billion, Steve. That's up 81%. And TTM free cash flow was 21.4 billion, and that was versus 19.7 billion the year previous. So, really impressive numbers from Amazon. There was a number of things that Jesse has said that he wanted to do, and that he thought that could improve margins just a few quarters ago. And one of those was his aim of switching to regional networks rather than having a large distribution center. This is definitely producing better margins. You can see that. Amazon mentioned on the call that they believe delivering the quickest, most convenient delivery service will lead to the highest customer satisfaction, which will drive demand. And they also said that Prime customers are now receiving the fastest delivery service Amazon has ever been able to achieve. So I think that's a really that's a real positive, and we're seeing a real benefit show through here. In terms of segment, North America came in at $87.9 billion. That was up 11%. International came in at $32.1 billion. That's up 16%. And AWS revenue came in at $23.1 billion. That was also up 12%. Amazon mentioned on the call that customers have actually started trending away from the one-year deals that we saw last year with AWS and have started trending towards a three-year deal. And that does mean softer prices, but it does mean that that revenue becomes more durable. So I think you should probably prefer that. They mentioned that they are seeing the pace and volume of closed deals pick up, and that we should be encouraged by the strong last couple of months of new deals signed. What was interesting is not all customers are actually shutting down workloads. A very significant portion of the optimization are customers taking advantage of enhanced price performance capabilities in AWS, and they're actually making use of it. So loads of interesting things on there. I'll just quickly flick through a couple of other things that I pulled out of the call. In Q4, Jassy said that AWS deals will start to show up. They said that they've signed some fairly large ones in that quarter, so we should expect a better quarter out of that. And he said, for perspective, we signed several new deals in September with an effective date in October that won't show up in any GAAP reported number for Q3, but the collection of which is higher than our total reported deal volume for all of Q3. Deal signings are quite lumpy, and revenue happens over several years, but we like the recent deal momentum we're seeing. Top of mind for most companies continues to be generative AI. AWS now is $92 billion revenue run rate business versus the opportunity. They said that 90% of global IT is still on prem, so you know, potentially still very early on this. And if you believe that that equation is going to flip, then there's still a lot more here for AWS and for all of the cloud providers. They're seeing strong customer interest in generative AI. They think this could be worth tens of billions of revenue for AWS in just the next couple of years. And also, interestingly, Steve, they threw in that they think Prime could end up being profitable in its own right. They're going to focus on having exclusive content, having new ad tiers and ad-free tiers, similar to what Netflix has done in early 2024. And that we should continue to see strong and durable growth in high-margin ads, which is over, which will be profit margin accretive to Amazon. In terms of the guide, Steve, they said that they reckon sales will grow about 12% to $167 billion, and they reckon they'll generate about $11 billion in EBIT. So there really wasn't an awful lot to fall out with here in Amazon's report. This was a very strong report. The only thing I was sort of worried about was this AWS coming in at 12%. I thought when you looked at Azure, they were quite clearly making ground on Amazon. But obviously, the guide and the information given in the call there was really key when they were saying that they've essentially signed some fairly huge deals. So I was looking at the Synergy Research Group. They did a quick report on this. They're really good at tracking share of worldwide revenues, and they list the big five essentially, which is Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Alibaba, and IBM, and they just track their market share over the over the years, and they also compare it to others. Amazon has been pretty steady. It's been about 34% to about 33% over, this is from Q4 18 to this most recent quarter. Microsoft has grown from about 15% to about 23%. Google has grown from about 7% to about 11%. Alibaba is fairly static. It's gone from 5 to 4, and IBM has fallen from about 7 to about 3%. And again, I'll put this chart up for people who are watching. So they're not taking market share from Amazon here, which is interesting. Amazon's market share is static. Google and Microsoft are growing. Alibaba is static. IBM is falling. It's others and IBM that this market share is coming from. So basically what we're seeing here is the three members of big tech continuing to take market share from others and not from each other, which is kind of bullish for all three of them, Steve, I think. How about you?
Yeah, I'm reminded of that Charlie Munger thing where he said he, as a younger lawyer, probated someone's estate who basically got some money, divided it into five bits and lumped it into five chemicals companies, sorry, and left it. And she chose General Electric, Dow, DuPont, and he can't remember the other two. This is a while back now. And she made loads of money in these things. And he said to her, why did you do that? And she said, well, look, I figured that electricity and chemistry were the coming things. So I just bought a load of shares and left them. You might well think, and it's kind of tempting here to think, that stuff like cloud and ad revenues are the coming thing. And I could see a decent case for buying all three of the companies we mentioned so far, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. We haven't covered Microsoft any detail, and we don't. But if someone said, look, I think cloud is the coming thing, I'm just going to buy these three things, I'd find that quite hard to argue here, that there's a growing market that will be, in some sense, shared between this bunch of participants. And if you own them all, does it really matter which one of your companies is bringing in the which bit of the market? Arguably not. You spent quite a while talking about AWS there. It was a bit that stuck out to me as well. Jassy was... So they reported 12% revenue growth. Over the last six quarters, their year-over-year revenue growth has been coming right down with AWS. I flagged this a few quarters ago, actually. It's been coming down longer than that, but it's gone from 33% growth to 28% growth to 20% growth to 16% growth to 12% growth to 12% growth. So it's leveled off, and Jassy was keen to point out that it's now got to the point where they think it might be steady. 12% growing into the future, into for the foreseeable, would be perfectly nice. That's fine from what I can see of it. The kind of concern I was mentioning a little while ago is that it isn't looking like leveling off, and I don't know how low this growth can go. It's not terribly impressive compared to what you saw out of either Google or Microsoft, and people were disappointed with Google here. But yeah, so it was good to see. Jassy talks about deals that were signed in September should show up in the Q4 update, and switching to 3-year rather than 1-year subscriptions will give them a bit more visibility on revenue. Although, as you point out, locking in prices for 3 years means those prices don't go up for 3 years. So that might be kind of wise in an environment where there might be tighter conditions coming. People looking to pull, if you believe Ruth Porat, people looking to pull back on spending, get them committed now then, before they have a chance to reconsider next year and say, actually, we won't kind of go this route, or we can't afford the way we're doing things at the moment. We need to find a cheaper alternative. So encouraging there. I mean, the big standout to my mind was their ad revenue going higher here. They had ad services growth in 26% revenue. That takes them up to about 12 billion. I think it rounds to 12 billion here. That's growing quite nicely in terms of growth. That's consistently between sort of 20 and 30% revenue growth year over year each quarter. And that's got quite a way to go higher. If you think Google, I'm not saying they're the same as Google here, but Google's about five times that in terms of revenue. There's still some way to go on this, and ad services are coming through nicely. We know this to be a high margin business. That was, to my mind, one of the real kind of bright points here, that keeps moving forward. AWS is where I sort of looked for cause for concern, although I wouldn't overstate that concern at this point. The market liked it as well, although in fairness, Amazon had been trickling lower in the days after reports from some of the other big techs as well, because news about cloud spending digital advertising to some extent was already in, and investors were inching lower. So certainly they went lower after the Alphabet report, and this went some way to putting some of that back, I think probably justifiably in my view. I said before, I think all of these are holds at the moment in my head, and I probably would continue to, I still do see this as a hold, own it, not buying it, not selling it.
Yeah, I agree with you here, Steve. I'm glad you touched on ads as well, because that's where I was going to go next. So it's a nice little segue in. Advertising is now running at 48 billion annual run rate, so it's a sizable part of Amazon's business, growing at 26% year on year. Just in the last 3 years, Steve, they've taken their advertising revenue from about 5 billion a quarter to about 12.1 billion a quarter. So it's incredible growth, really. 150% growth in advertising in the last 3 years. I think we said this a year or so ago, is that we think Amazon's advertising is going to be very, very strong for them, mainly because when you when you're searching on Amazon for a product, you're searching with the intent to buy, or at the very least to check a product and consider a purchase, and they directly link you to a product. It couldn't be any smoother for a purchaser. So yeah, really, really impressive from Amazon. I mean, there was growth across the board. Online store grew 7%, physical store grew 6%, third-party services grew 20% year-on-year. Prime and Audible grew 14%, advertising 26%. Yeah, AWS was 12%, and other was the only one that declined 3%, but I'm not entirely sure what's in other at the moment. Assuming that's Zooks and things like that. But really impressive. I mean, completely doing a really good job of screwing down costs. I mean, it was only a year ago. Remember, people were starting to call for Jassy's head, and I think he's doing a marvelous job, really. And I think I'm interested to see where he takes Amazon next.
I mean, thinking about the immediate next here, the guidance for the next quarter came in a little bit light. And if you look at Amazon's revenue breakdown, you mentioned those segments there, Steve, and not all revenue is equivalent here, since margins are wildly, wildly different between, say, AWS and first party e-commerce, basically. But a lot of its revenue does come from e-commerce. It's still kind of thought of as mostly an e-commerce platform, and for justifiable reasons, I think. Guidance came in between 160 billion and 167 billion. Market was hoping for 166.6. Strictly, that is within that range. The expectation is higher than the midpoint, though. And it's probably something to keep an eye on then. Amazon, of course, a big retailer. That holiday season, that Christmas season, is an important quarter for them. So there was also a little bit of kind of cause for pessimism there, I suppose, even though stuff generally seems to be growing well, especially the higher margin stuff here. It's a good example, I think, of this cost cutting coming into action.
I think this guide is a little bit sandbagged, to be honest with you, Steve. I think they might come out of this quite considerably stronger. I think when I was looking down the figures, I was fairly convinced that if these AWS deals are the size that they are explaining to us in the call, that I think they've probably subbed out some of them just in case they don't go through for the guide. I would expect this to be on the upper end of guidance to maybe even above guidance. But I guess we'll see. It's nice for Amazon to be in a position where they could potentially sandbag guidance and show, you know, what would be good growth. 12% year on year is good growth. But we'll see. That would be my guess. I don't know that. It just seems apparent to me.
Yeah, let's see what happens. And in that case, that would be nice, right? If they're in a position to kind of talk things down a little bit and provide surprise further down the line. Shall we move on? Next one. Okay, let's talk about Meta then in that case, because we often do on this show, despite neither of us owning it anymore. But revenue came in at, I've got 34 billion or so, or just slightly more than that for the quarter. Earnings per share came in at $4.39. Revenue was up nicely. Earnings per share nearly tripled. So this was, you can see Meta's year of efficiency starting to come through here. The stock is up 137% year to date. It was down, though, after the guidance offered out here. Guidance came in partly slightly light and partly slightly wide, which is to say they offered a bigger range than they normally offer for Q4. The reason being, they think, they claim they're seeing geopolitical uncertainty. So in this case, Israel-Palestine, but they said it doesn't really matter kind of what form of geopolitical uncertainty you're talking about, will weigh on their customer spending here. So they've stretched out their bracket slightly, and the bracket in general came in slightly lower than the market was expecting. So the stock slipped a little bit. Like I say, that slip still leaves them 137% up year to date compared to an S&P 500 that's up 7 or so. So let's not get too carried away on the idea that this is a dip. Meta knows what a dip looks like. Meta investors know what a dip looks like. It's your stock selling at a PE of 11. And people saying, well, you're just going to endlessly set money on fire, like me, saying you're just going to endlessly set money on fire with this metaverse project thing. Family of Apps did pretty well, actually. They put up something like 23% revenue growth in there, which was impressive. And in general, the report looked kind of it looked kind of strong across the board. So number of users, whether it's dailies or monthlies, whether it's Facebook or the family of apps as a whole, was up again slightly. So still better engagement, costs better under control. There's plenty for Meta. People who were optimistic about Meta during the time when no one else was, when it looked like basically a metaverse bonfire, people here, I think, will be saying this is what we were seeing. This is what we figured this company could be. And I think they will justifiably be, I think they deserve to be considered correct in foreseeing that on this occasion. So, encouraging stuff, Steve. Not one you own. Any thoughts here? Probably not a time to buy it either for you, I would guess.
No, not one that I would buy. I think I'm pretty exposed to advertising at the moment. I think I probably wouldn't want to take on any more advertising risks. But Meta performed really well. There was nothing in this report that was particularly jumping out at me as being a problem here. I mean, their average revenue per user was up double digits in every segment. Daily active users was strong growth across the board. So 5% worldwide, but 3% UCAN, 1% Europe, 6% Asia Pacific, 6% rest of world. And even the business metrics are things that you want to look at. Ad impressions was up 31%, so more eyeballs looking at ads. The price per ad actually fell 6%, which tells you that they sold a lot more advertising in the report. But I mean, looking at those margin, gross profit margin 82%, EBIT margin 40%, net income margin 34%, operating cash flow margin 60%, free cash flow margin 40%. They're not metrics that showing a company that's in any particular trouble. I guess the red flags, the amber flags, is still Reality Labs. Although I was largely impressed with Lex Fridman and Zuckerberg showing it off in detail. Revenue of $210 million, down 26%. That's not very impressive. Minus $3.7 billion in EBIT, a margin of minus $1,782, if my maths is correct, Steve. That's also down about 50,000 basis points if you want me to switch between the two. Reality Labs is very loss-making. Looking at the call, Steve, they're expecting to incur higher operating costs from a larger infrastructure footprint next year. And the second big driver is on payroll as well. So they're looking like they're going to start hiring again after firing. So maybe this sort of period of looking after investors showing that Meta is a very highly profitable company is just going to start coming towards an end, Stephen. Maybe they're going to start hiring again and growing the company in terms of footprint. What do you think?
I think if that happens, it'll be interesting to see how quickly investors forget. It feels like, go back a year or so, investors forgot that Meta is the kind of business that can make a lot of money if it decides to pull out its costs. Previously, it wasn't. It was attempting to do a whole bunch of things, including Reality Labs, and was sending a lot of money into that project, which was weighing on margins, which was weighing on earnings, which was weighing on free cash generation. When that happens, what you get is much, much lower end numbers, basically, across the board. And if it also coincides with an occasional slip in your user numbers, then it looks really bad. But Reality Labs has kind of always been an eyesore. It still is, in terms of loss-making stuff. And it's not a product I'm massively enamored by. I'm still not convinced by metaverse stuff. Despite the fact that Apple appears to be wanting to pile into that with headsets as well, I'm not interested in them doing it either. This to me looks like a COVID idea. I think I've called it before. We might nowadays call it a zero interest rates story type thing in our kind of more contemporary language. The issue for the question for Meta is whether they can keep it as enough of an eyesore that people are happy to ignore it because the rest of the business is making so much money that, well, look, if you treat it like Google other bets or something, we don't complain that Waymo is basically, as far as we can tell, a kind of a money fire. I could quite happily see the same way about Reality Labs. But one of the things people were complaining about while things were looking much worse for the company was, why can't you be like Google and just do like loads of random small other bets? Meta's answer would be, because we think this one's actually quite good and worth all the money that we're putting into this, so why would we go and chuck it into a bunch of other stuff that we don't really have much of a clue about? They may be right, they may be wrong. That would have been their kind of line of thinking here. So I'll be interested to see if they can stop keep Reality Labs as the kind of sort of irritation that it might be rather than a problem, because I don't see much good coming out of this. The only other thing I would do differently if I was Meta, by the way, is I would stop, or I would announce now that I'm going to stop breaking out users on Facebook platform. I would say I'll just launch a family of apps thing, or maybe even break out Instagram if you want. I'm not sure Facebook is really the way that users are thinking about it at the moment. I think Facebook might actually see declining user numbers without it really being that big of a deal for Meta. I'm not sure that's where its real action is and where its real users kind of mainly are. I've switched from being a daily Facebook user to a monthly Facebook user, in that I log in more than, I go on my Facebook more than once a month. I don't go on it every day by any means. There's a lot of room in between those two things. I probably go on it maybe once a week. I'm a weekly active user, perhaps. But if I was Meta, I would say now, look, we're going to stop breaking this out because we don't think it's relevant. Much like Netflix has recently said, we're not providing subscriber growth numbers anymore because we don't think they're relevant. We'll provide like other metrics that we think are important. In Facebook's case, family of apps. In Netflix's case, free cash. But enough for the moment with the Facebook stuff. Let's just leave all that in family of apps for the time being, because I think that's only the kind of thing that can, I think that's the kind of thing that can only make trouble for them going forward. And I think that trouble would probably be unjustified if it just showed up in Facebook's user base. That's pretty much my thoughts on that, though, Steve.
Yeah, well, I'm a Meta Never user. I've actually deleted my account. So, but it was interesting that I saw a couple.
See, I was wondering where the growth was going to come from as well.
Yeah, maybe I could rejoin.
We will get you back in.
And to be honest with you, I never use Facebook anyway, so deleting it was just the logical next step. But for it to still be growing, Steve, is quite interesting, because I saw that Twitter's daily active users has fallen, or X as it's now known, has fallen by about 20%. So, but some of that could be the getting rid of bots issue, but I think some of it might just be people who don't like Elon Musk. Also, Threads took a few people away. I'm not sure if that is still going though. I saw a lot of people, Steve, coming out saying that they wanted Zuck to just cut off Reality Labs, and I disagree with that to some degree. I don't mind him having a project that he's passionate about and is plowing money into, but I also don't want to dissuade him from trying to diversify Facebook's revenue stream somewhat as well. So I want him to keep trying things and, you know, throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks. And I think he might have something in Reality Labs. I'm gonna stick my neck out and say that he may have something in Reality Labs. I mean, I don't think it's gonna be a massive earner for him, but I also don't want to discourage him from you know, spending good money on trying to get something to work. So, I'm not quite ready to tell him to call Reality Labs just yet, but I also don't think it should be losing about $4 billion in EBIT every quarter.
Interesting. I think of this as a zero interest rate story, which I'm okay with, because you're allowed to take punts on zero interest rate stories, but you're not allowed to have them be getting in the way of your kind of otherwise very, very good business. Okay, should we talk about something that's not such a good business at the moment, or at least arguably isn't, but might be priced slightly better than these ones that are very good businesses?
Well, this is another zero interest rate story, probably. So let's see how we go. So for company number four, we thought we'd cover Enphase. And I've entitled this piece that I've written, "Oh, Enphase." I mean, we sort of knew this one was going to be bad. And we knew this because SolarEdge had reported just the week previous and had dropped by about a third of its share price. And Enphase had only fallen about half of that. It was like the market was holding on and saying, well, this one's a little bit of a better business. We've given this one a higher valuation. So maybe it's like a superior company and has more durable demand. Well, as you'll know, if you follow Enphase, the market took the rest of that fall on Friday. So I've got the figure, Steve. Let's see what we can find out. Revenue, Steve, came in at $551 million, and that's a 17% contraction year on year, and was only $1 million above the lower end of their guidance, and it missed Wall Street's guidance by about $15 million. Earnings were $1.02, that's non-GAAP, but it's also an 18% fall. Gross margin was a beat, though, Steve, which was about 3% above guidance. I watched Brian Stoffel's video on this, and he said that might be the indication of a moat, that despite the fact that revenue is falling, they're not getting desperate to sell things at a cheaper price and managing to maintain margins may be the indication that their product is valuable. Make of that what you wish. But free cash flow, Steve, fell. It was over $100 million to just over $122 million. Inverter shipments were down 10% year on year, but actually down 12% sequentially. In Europe, they fell much sharper. They were actually down 35%. And SolarEdge did tell us this was going to happen. Batteries were also down about 35%. US revenue slipped about 22%. International was actually up 10% year on year, so a little bright spot. In the call, CEO Badri Kothandaraman, it's an interesting name, not really sure how to pronounce it, I'm almost certain I've butchered it. He said this little interesting tidbit. So he said that utility rates are continuing to move higher in California, with one California utility recently requesting a 22% rate hike. So assuming that even half of this rate hike is going to be approved by the CPUC, which is the utilities regulator, the payback for a NEM 3.0 solar plus battery system will come close to a NEM 2.0 solar only system. So that's pretty good. I had a look at this, Steve, because I didn't know what a NEM was, but I understand California is quite comfortably their largest market. And I found this little bit of information from solar.com. Following years of policy skirmishes, revisions, and a mad dash to grandfather systems into the previous net metering plan, a new solar billing structure known as NEM 3.0 is in effect for California's three investor-owned utilities. NEM 3.0 features a 75% reduction in export rates. So this is the value of excess electricity that you generate that's pushed back to the grid by a solar system. So thereby, that reduces the overall savings and increasing the payback period of home solar. This new policy is designed in part to encourage homeowners to pair battery storage with their solar panels to become more self-sufficient, but also to contribute to a more resilient energy grid. That sounds like what we've got in the UK, Steve, where the utilities are happy to charge you 40p to provide you with electricity plus a standing charge, but we'll only take it off you for 3 or 5p. So we're very much used to that. But this is a bit double-edged. I think the benefits here are being marginalised, the cost of finance is increasing. And it goes without saying that Enphase should and did expect to hit to their growth. I don't think we should be overly surprised about that. But when utility rates start going up 22%, these benefits start to creep back. So it will be interesting to see how we go. Enphase, Dave, think it's going to go shit, because they've guided for $300 to $350 million in revenue next quarter, and that's a fall of over 55%. Wall Street actually wanted them to expect $601 million. So Wall Street 601. I'll just reiterate that. Enphase said 300 to 350. They missed this target, Steve. No price is going to be cheap enough to buy Enphase. They've also pulled their earnings guidance, which you wouldn't, you shouldn't be shocked about when a company's predicting a 55% fall in revenue. So I guess it's our job as investors here, Steve, to try and figure out if this is the right time to purchase some stock. And I've done a quick reverse DCF, Steve. They're doing about $760 million in free cash flow. Again, I'll put this up for people who are looking. Revenue is going to fall 55%, Steve, so I've halved that free cash flow number to $380 million. I've given standard terminal growth rate of 2, discount rate of 10. You would need 15% growth, Steve. That's including 1% dilution. So you'll need 15% growth in free cash flow from that lower number to make it worth its valuation today, Steve. If you're going in at $760 million, then you only need 4% growth for a 10% return. I think you would disregard that number. That $760 million is a figure from the past. It is definitely not what you should be using. But 15% growth, Steve, with 1% dilution, I don't think that's a million miles away from being achievable. It all depends on where interest rates land. What do you think?
This is a legit company, right? This is a company that makes products and it ships them and they work, right? And we can talk about what the market looks like and how and what things might get in the way of that and so on. But this is an actual kind of proper business profit-making company that is I think, likely to be around for kind of some time. Famous last words here. I think it's really interesting, those guidance numbers to start off with compared to where we were before. So you said 551 million was the revenue from the quarter just gone. Is that right? Did I get the right number there? Yeah. And so Wall Street was thinking, okay, it was thinking basically the way I was thinking about this. So Enphase, one of the leading inverter businesses, so one of the leading solar panel outfits going around. Clearly there's some momentum for this kind of idea, and that waxes and wanes depending on the economic cycle a little bit. When interest rates are lower, people are very keen on doing things that will pay them less of a return, but switching over to green energy as much as they possibly can. When things are a bit tighter, they're thinking, well, hang on, we better stick with what we got for the time being. I got other priorities elsewhere for my money. And the question, so you expect their fortunes to wax and wane. You expect their growth rate to expand and contract. Wall Street is presumably thinking what I was thinking, although I'm not a Wall Street analyst and certainly not in this sector, which was, okay, so sometimes they'll grow quickly and sometimes they'll grow slowly. Sometimes they might put up 20% growth, sometimes they might put up 2% growth. They weren't necessarily expecting, by the look of this, and nor was I, that they will go backwards at any given moment. It's one thing to say, look, it's really tough to grow at the moment, so we're only guiding for 5% growth or whatever. We think that will get better because there are particular macro headwinds at the moment, call them inflation, call them rising interest rates, whatever you want here. And when those blow off, then we'll find that we have stronger growth again coming through. So growth will be happening in the future. At what rate, it's hard to say. Tough for the near future, better for the longer future. That's not what they're saying, though, right? They're saying, oh, in a bad year, we might go half backwards, effectively, from 600, or sorry, the 600 you were expecting to 300, which is what we're actually going to manage here, which is way, way down from 551. And that appears to be quite the shock to analysts here, and I think it's probably a surprise to me as well. I thought that this would grow. The only question is at what rate. I was interested to see margins holding up. My initial reaction is the twofold. One is, my initial reaction is the opposite to Brian Stoffel's reaction. By the way, it's to me an indication it doesn't have much in the way of operating leverage in that case. Which isn't massively surprising for a manufacturing business. You have to make these things regardless of whether you make, and you have to make them every time you sell them, basically. It's not like a software company where you just kind of make something once and distribute it. But I was thinking in this case, that's the opposite of a moat here. It means that, okay, margins hold up pretty well when you come back down, but they don't expand as much when you go up either, because if you sell an extra 100,000 of these things, you have to make an extra 100,000 of these things. You have to buy in materials for an extra 100,000 of these things, and no doubt you get some economies of scale, but they're not huge. Otherwise, you would find those going away at the moment, and you would find that cutting into margins on the way down. So, my view is the opposite. I do think, however, that means that your DCF calculator is using the right ideas here. It's otherwise, you would worry about saying, okay, revenue's going to halve, so I'm going to halve free cash, or revenue 55% off, so I'm going to halve free cash here. If you were looking at a business that, to me, looked moaty with an operating, with a big scale advantage, and therefore economies of scale, and therefore operating leverage, I might be asking you, okay, revenue's going to halve, doesn't that mean we're going to lose about three quarters of the free cash flow here? Your answer to that's going to be no, because margins appear to hold up pretty well on the way back down. So that you're an interesting place to start off with there. I don't see it's going to be that difficult for them to get back to their previous levels here for revenue. There's a big headwind blowing in their face, but that turns around as forcefully as it kind of comes towards them at the moment. And I see that as a sign that when they get a tailwind behind them, that will push hard too as well. So I think there'll be times when they just can't help but make money. Admittedly, we've probably seen some of those just recently, just because of the environment they find themselves in and the industry they find themselves in. People buy their stuff without having to do basically anything. At the moment, much harder for them to sell them to anybody almost at any price. So I think you can put decent numbers on this for growth, because a lot of it is just bringing you back to where you once were. If you start from that low base, you've seen what's achievable in a good environment. I think there is secular growth to be had for this kind of industry, as well as kind of cyclical ups and downs. So I think the long-term picture looks up Exactly when it looks up, I don't know, and at what rate, I don't know, because the macro stuff will cause that to fluctuate, and I find it hard to predict on any given year or quarter. But to me, this looks quite positive here. I think if there's a time for buying Enphase, this could well be it.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there, Steve. That was going to be my next question. I think this is around the kind of area that you would, you would think buying Enphase was probably a good idea, and it might be something I do on Monday, Steve. To be totally honest with you, I mean, these calculations, 15% growth is quite a heavy growth amount in free cash flow, but realistically, that means we're taking 5 years to get back to 764. Million, which is essentially what they're doing on the trailing 12 months. So it's not a huge overstatement to think that in 5 years they could potentially be doing the free cash flow they were doing last year. I don't feel like that's a massive leap of a statement. So I'm quite interested in Enphase here, and I'm also going to say just I've finished tinkering with this DCF. It's actually Brian Feraldi's reverse DCF, but I felt like it had a missing feature on it, so I've been tinkering with adding buybacks and dilution to it, and I've got them working to a point now where I think they're fairly robust. So if anybody wants a copy of the reverse DCF, let me know, and I'll pop it in the description for you. Like I said, I don't use it solely for valuations, but it is fun for stuff like this, Steve, to just get a grasp of something quickly and see where you think it needs to be to meet that kind of the price it's trading at today. I must admit, I quite like it. I think it's a pretty good thing. I've also changed some of the colours because they've done it in, like, it looks like a pile of sick in all the colours they've done. So I've been getting rid of some of the colours to make it a bit more appetising. But I don't have much more on Enphase. Do you have much more, or shall we wrap her up?
No, just a couple of little bits here, I think. When something re-rates quite dramatically on the DCF thing, it's always interesting to plug it into there to work out what's now kind of implied. And by re-rates, I mean quite dramatically re-rates. So stuff can move a percent or two either direction. It doesn't make an awful lot of difference to the numbers there. But when something takes a big hit and suddenly starts trading at what looks like a very different multiple, either higher or lower, because there's clearly been some sort of shock, it's now worth looking at what those new assumptions are. And the DCF calculator can be an important part of doing that, or a reverse one in your case. I said now could be the time to buy for Enphase. I'll just qualify that a little bit, in that I'd like to think they're getting it all out there in terms of pulling guidance and halving revenue guidance. Pulling earnings guidance, halving revenue guidance, and so on. It wouldn't massively surprise me to see another bad quarter and the stock goes lower, by the way. So if I were looking to buy this thing, I mean, you saw it happen to Meta not so long ago, right? They had their user thing came down, then their margin thing came down, then a few other things came down. It's kind of odd the way that the market, and I suppose this is where opportunity is, right? Enphase are telling you there's bad news coming or bad results coming. And I wonder whether you might still see the market, I'm not going with that. That sounds like a prediction, but it wouldn't massively surprise me to see the market still react badly to actually bad results here, even ones that are, suppose Enphase did exactly what it guided for here, I wouldn't be surprised to see this rate lower again because of some sort of excuse about future earnings, right? They're not forecasting a bad quarter. I think they're forecasting a bad few here. So when guidance doesn't immediately say, okay, cool, that was the bad quarter, now we're back to where we are, wouldn't surprise me to see it slip lower again. But we'll see what happens on that one.
Well, there's an element of that as well, though, isn't there? There's an element of disbelieving Enphase, because if you think there's going to be a drop in your demand and you're predicting 40%, then it always sort of says we'll go a little, if you're going to predict 40%, you might as well predict 55%, because you can sandbag your guidance a little bit, you can surprise to the upside, and also it gives you a little bit of room just in case the quarter gets a little bit worse. And I think there's an element of Wall Street looking at this now saying, okay, we don't believe 55%, but we might believe 40 or 45, and if it does come in with a fall of 55 or God forbid worse, I think this goes a lot further down, Steve. And that's the bet, isn't it? The bet is whether you believe that this is sandbag guidance and they'll perform to the upside, or whether this is genuinely a company putting their arms in the air saying, oh, we haven't sold an inverter in 2 weeks, so I have no idea what we're going to end up being. One of the things I did note in the call, which I just thought of then, was they did mention that a lot of their sell-through, because they're business-to-business, remember, you can't ring up Enphase and buy a solar panel collection off you. You buy it from an installer. They did say that quite a lot of their installers are still dealing with high inventory. So we will have to see how that goes.
That is extraordinarily cyclical. I mean, that's kind of the latest cyclical word we've been looking at over the last few weeks. They might be disbelieving. Wall Street might be disbelieving of Enphase. They might not be fully appreciating what Enphase is telling them, even if they kind of take it as plausible. But disbelieving things and not fully appreciating what they're being told is basically our listeners' stock in trade, I think. So that won't be lost on them. That's pretty much it for our show this week. Thank you all very much for listening. If you disbelieve stuff that we've said, let us know in the comments. If you don't fully appreciate what we've said, feel free to demonstrate that in the comments too. And if you actually enjoyed it, then leave us a note down below. Don't forget to sign up to Steve D's retirement fund, also known as Webull. Sign ups through clicking in the links. And
20
if
free shares.
Joined Trading 212 yet, 20 free shares of who knows what.
50 quid, my gift to you.
50 quid, his gift to you, sponsored by somebody else. Anyway, that's all for now. Thanks for listening, and bye, everyone.